the shelf, you know, yellow liquid, smelt it, it's very clear straight away what it is. And you put two and two together, and this has happened because there's a climate of fear, and you're afraid if you go to the toilet, which can take 5-10 minutes, you know, huge warehouse through security, and people are being told, being accused of taking so-called idle time by Amazon for doing this. Everything which takes away from productivity at Amazon is seen as you're doing something wrong.
We have 10 seconds. We have 10 seconds. You said at one warehouse in the UK, Amazon workers called ambulances more than 115 times in 3 years.
Yeah, that was the warehouse I worked in, yeah. So that says it all, really, in my view.
Well, we're going to leave it there, but we're going to do part two with you. We're going to post it online. We want to thank you for being with us. And Juan, thanks so much for that report. And again, we're going to link to your reporter's investigative pieces, the print pieces. They are multimedia talents at democracynow.org. James Bloodworth, UK-based reporter, author of Hired, 6 months undercover in low-wage Britain. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the 13th annual Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square in Portland. American Indian Day is a traditional showcase and celebration of American Indian and Alaskan Native cultures and community, which raises awareness concerning the challenges that Native American people face in this country. This event features vendors, educational booths, food, entertainment, and more. Again, that's Dancing in the Square American Indian Day Celebration Powwow on Friday, September 7th from noon to 7 p.m. at Pioneer Courthouse Square, 700 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU programming is made possible by KABU listener members and support from Portland Saturday Market, 45 years of handmade arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, and local music in downtown Portland, featuring live music and Kids Corner events. Portland Saturday Market every Saturday and Sunday, and Waterfront Park now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more online at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
Why hear a sound? Beware from the rocks, from the ground, in the air.
Devastation. They privatize the nickel dime. Our lives were gasping to survive the worldwide plantation. Our water, air, land, homes, jobs, food, schools, and books. Who snuck and took it? The Wall Street harvested it, picking our bones and our scabs just like a vulture while spreading the scourge of global monoculture. Cause they want you a consumer, dazing in a stupor, apathetic, sedated, and politically neutered. Or you can be a real citizen.
Revolution can be a fear to rise.
And good morning. Here we are again. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I am Paul Roland. And that was the Reverend Billy in the Stop Shopping Choir. CD's been out a couple years now, I think. I had him live in the studio at one time. Not sure if they were singing that. Anyway, we got a full show. We got Tony DeFalco live in the studio. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning.
Tony is executive director at Verde, which is a main promoter of the Portland Clean Energy Fund initiative drive. And hopefully we'll have Adrian Cato, youth organizer at Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, either call in or come in. We will see. But if not, we've got Tony. So tell us about Verde.
Thanks for having us on. We really appreciate the opportunity to share with listeners out there. And I'm fortunate to be able to do this good work at Verde. Verde is a nonprofit that focuses on building environmental wealth in communities. And we do that through social enterprises and outreach and advocacy. And what we've seen over the past 15 years of our existence has been a increasing disparate impact of environmental impacts of the climate, for example, and access to economic opportunity relative to improving the climate. So we're really trying to bring those things together by creating ways in which we can improve the climate and create a just transition.
What is environmental wealth?
Environmental wealth refers to both the assets of environmental infrastructure, like, for example, bike lanes or stormwater infrastructure or solar generation, clean energy, as well as the wealth that goes along with it. So the folks that design those infrastructure assets, the folks that install and maintain them. And so what we've seen is primarily middle-class white adoption and generation of economic benefits, and then those assets tend to go into those communities first. So we like to flip that around and really create that wealth in low-income and people of color communities.
I think you say environmental infrastructure. I think of like rivers and mountains and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. Those are the natural elements. We tend to focus on the built environment with our enterprise. But we also believe in the importance of protecting and enhancing water quality, water quantity, air quality, and so forth. So that's an important part of our policy objectives as well.
So it's Maria Hernandez, who works with Opal, sent me this description of you and called Verde leading promoter of this Portland Clean Energy Fund. So talk about your First of all, I'm sure our listeners know about the Portland Clean Energy Fund, but probably better to just go over it real briefly and then talk about your group's role in promoting that.
Sure, thanks. I think the really key point about the Portland Clean Energy Fund is that it is essentially about climate justice. And I think that we all are starting to increasingly talk about the importance of justice in environmental protection efforts. But we have yet to make serious commitments of investment into communities that have been most impacted by the fossil fuel economy and yet to benefit from the transition to the clean economy and clean energy. So the Portland Clean Energy Fund is really a first step toward doing that. And what it does is it basically creates avenues for investments in clean energy, renewable energy, energy efficiency here in Portland. And it directs those investments into the communities that have been hit the hardest. So it really focuses the attention on how do we create jobs. It creates jobs. It creates economic opportunities for low-income people, people of color, women-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses, to be able to then install infrastructure like solar panels on top of affordable housing projects, for example, or community centers, so that those energy benefits that accrue into communities that have had the least benefit, and at the same time, reducing carbon emissions while creating these economic opportunities for folks.
And I'd like to remind people of the number that you can call to join this conversation, which is 503-231-8187. Don't wait until the last 20 minutes of the show, as often happens. Because, people like to get a sense for what the conversation is. But we'd like to start the conversation early and give you a chance to interact with Tony and ask questions, make your own statements about these issues as you wish. 503-231-8187. I'm speaking with Tony DeFalco, Executive Director at Verde. And talk a little more about what's your role at Verde? You're Executive Director, obviously. How long have you been working there?
I've been fortunate to be hanging around the company for about 10 years. I started as a volunteer and then did some consulting, and they finally figured out I wasn't going anywhere. So they hired me on as the Living COLI coordinator back in 2012. And that led to a role as deputy director in 2016 and now executive director in 2018.
Living COLI?
Living COLI is a collaboration of four organizations: Habitat for Humanity, Portland Metro East, the Native American Youth and Family Center, Hacienda Community Development Corporation, and Verde. And our effort has been to prevent displacement using sustainability as an anti-poverty strategy in the COLI neighborhood. So we've braided together traditional resources, social service resources, affordable housing, along with environmental investments. For example, we recently completed building COLI Park, a 25-acre landfill in the COLI neighborhood. That
I was at the grand opening.
Fabulous, fabulous. So this is very exciting. The park itself is a long-time blight in the neighborhood, where you had lots of folks that wanted to access it and wanted to park there, but it was cut off by barbed wire and it's sort of a dangerous place. And now we have a facility that can serve the community, and it's a beautiful park. I encourage everybody to go out and check it out. But I would note, at the same time that we built that park, we also, together, those four groups acquired 5 acres of property in the neighborhood. And that's essential when you build these new infrastructure assets, because you want to make sure that the folks that live in the neighborhood are able to continue to enjoy those assets as the neighborhood essentially gentrifies in terms of property values. And so I think that's a really important aspect to share.
I'd like to welcome our other guest. You're Adrian, I assume?
I am, yes.
Didn't hear your microphone on. Go ahead again.
Oh, hi.
There you go. now everybody can hear you.
Great.
Adrian Cato, is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, that's correct.
Youth organizer at OPAL Environmental Justice Oregon. Talk about OPAL real briefly. I know you just got here.
Yeah, I can talk about OPAL. So OPAL stands for Organizing People, Activating Leaders. And we are a grassroots organization that works towards creating safe and healthy environments for the places where people live, work, learn, pray, and play. And I, in particular, work with predominantly youth of color in East Portland. And so I run a youth leadership program and campaigns for the changes that they would like to see in their communities.
And OPAL is also involved in this Portland Clean Energy Fund. Awesome.
Yes.
In what way?
So we're mainly a supporter. We are spending some time. We work towards getting petition signatures and those sort of things. But we're mainly supporters of PSEF.
So one of the things that I pay attention to that OPAL does, since I'm a transit rider, is the efforts to, that seems to be not the main, but it seems like, at least in terms of being visible publicly, it seems to be one of the things that people notice about OPAL. Mm-hmm. Want to just briefly talk about some of the transit work that your group does?
Yeah, absolutely. We work right now, so predominantly what we're working on with our youth is the Youth Pass program. So we're working towards expanding Youth Pass, ideally throughout the TriMet service district. So right now the program is only available to Portland Public Schools, and there's a youth-led campaign to expand it to Park Rose and David Douglas High Schools, which was successful in last year. And then now we're really working at the TriMet level and looking at HB 2017 and the funds that are coming in through that to put more of the funding towards expanding youth transit.
So I see we already have 3 callers, which is unusual at this early time in the show. And we will get to the callers, and we will get to talk more about the Clean Energy Fund and more broadly strategies to combat climate destabilization. But so what exactly do you do in organizing youth in that in those issues?
Yeah. So a lot of what I do is I'm kind of in and out of schools working on recruitment, you know, kind of trying to basically pull from youth that aren't always necessarily elevated as leaders first, but really, you know, it's part of our name. It's activation, right? It's activating leadership. So a lot of what I do is kind of building up the skills in order for them to, you know, testify at City Hall, be in meetings with officials, and be in meetings at TriMet. And a lot of that just skills building and public speaking, and as well as just some political education. So, you know, a lot of folks have not even heard of the term environmental justice in order to critically think about it. So we, you know, work with them in order to just kind of create that knowledge behind what it actually means.
So do you sort of identify potential leaders or people who seem to be more interested and sort of activate them? Is that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'll go into classrooms, do recruitment pitches, and then we do weekly membership meetings. So those are every Thursday at our office. We'll have folks there. And outside of that group, we also have an intern team that comes on. And so we work with them as well.
And so some people who might be listening and interested in getting involved could also get involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do they do that?
So you can get involved. You know, you can either contact OPAL as an organization or just show up to one of our meetings. We meet every Thursday 4 to 6 o'clock at our OPAL office on 82nd Avenue in Powell.
Okie doke. So I just wanted to set a little bit of a broader context, which I didn't do at the outset when I got in contact initially with Maria Hernandez, who's one of the contact people for the Clean Energy Fund initiative. And I told her that I wanted to talk more broadly about strategies to combat climate change, climate destabilization, global warming, because sometimes I think, you know, I've been active as an environmental activist for quite a while, or had been. Now I mainly do this radio show. But anyway, and you know, you have to evaluate each project and each campaign to see whether it's actually, you know, addressing the issues that it's supposed to address. And, you know, climate change is such a vast issue. It seems like people can say all sorts of things about, you know, whether it's going to. So anyway, so the, you know, I think we're all coming to grips with the fact that the climate is changing in a much more rapid and in different ways than we had imagined even a couple, 5, 10 years ago. That, you know, the climate models that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change scientists put out are not haven't actually been adequate to explain the actual changes that are going on in real time in terms of the breakup of the thickest Arctic ice, in terms of the calving, the melting of the Antarctic ice sheets, the Greenland ice sheet. There's really rapid changes that, you know, it's difficult to really for any person, even scientists, let alone lay people like ourselves. So anyway, I just think, you know, we have to measure up the efforts that we're doing to the actual reality of what's going on. I know there's a big issue, and I know that, you know, the day-to-day work of what we're doing basically consumes a lot of our attention, and sometimes we may not even be able to look at these broader issues. Anyway, I just want to kind of set that as a context. But before we get into that, I know we've got three people waiting for about 5 minutes, so let's just go to our first caller, Camilo. Go ahead, Camilo.
Good morning, Paul. Good morning, Tony. I didn't catch the name of the young lady from OPAL.
My name is Adrienne Cato.
Hi, Adrienne.
Hi.
I just want to say three things. First of all, to correct the characterization of Verde as a lead organization. Verde, and I'm sure Tony will agree, is one of about 8 different organizations that form a steering committee that all work together to implement this project. And
you want to name all those organizations, or?
Sure.
Okay.
NAACP, NIA, 350, PDX, Coalition of Communities of Color, NAACP, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and there may be one that I haven't remembered. Opal is also a part of that group.
Okay. Oh, and before you go on, I just wanted to, I just realized that the main reason for having this conversation is actually that there's an event this Saturday, which maybe, Camille, you can also talk about, called Rise for Climate Jobs and Justice Community Gathering, which is at Glen Haven Park from noon to 4 p.m. this Saturday. Anyway, go ahead. Go ahead, Camille.
So I do want to respond to the framing that you just described for this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to realize, of course, that climate change is a global problem and has systemic impacts, but we are concerned about with doing something locally in Portland. We know that very little is going to happen on the federal level, and it's still a struggle to do things on the state level. But here in Portland, we have a chance to make a significant impact. The results of this project will be $30 million to support those programs that Tony described earlier. And while it may not have a major impact on global pollution and climate change, it will have a very significant impact on those communities. And that's what I think we need to keep focused on. And as Tony said, this is about environmental justice. And I want to mention specifically one more thing, and I believe that the young lady from Opal mentioned it before, that we want to concentrate on the entire city, and that means east of 82nd Street. And I and a few other people in the leadership of our field team are organizing a campaign strategy to focus on Portland east of 82nd Street. And I wish to call out to any people who are in Portland east of 82nd and to any leadership and organizations to know that we are going to develop a campaign that brings our campaign strategy to you.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. You want to follow up on that?
Yeah, you know, I Camilo, it's good to hear from you. And I also would add to that, you know, this is, in some ways, I see this kind of climate action as this is the future of our climate action. I mean, I think what Camilo identified is a lack of leadership at the federal level, challenges to pass things at the state level. And most importantly is that this is a people of color-led movement. And I can't stress that enough, because what you've seen over the last 20, 25 years of climate activism in this country has been predominantly white, middle-class agenda settings. And what I think is really is over time is for people of color to articulate the solutions, for people of color to be in the leadership of those solutions, and for people of color to benefit disproportionately from the investments that come from those solutions, because our communities have been thrashed by this. We have been thrashed economically, we have been thrashed ecologically, our health is at risk, all in numbers way, way higher than middle-class white folks. And so I think what we've seen is this coming together of mainstream organizations like 350PDX and Sierra Club and Physicians for Social Responsibility and Audubon, with community of color-led organizations like Opal and Verde and the NAACP and Epano and NEA, to say, we can do this, we can do this together, and this will set the example. And so as far as the scale, 26 cities are ready to replicate this if we win. That scale.
What do you mean?
26 cities, if we win here in Portland, 26 cities are poised to do the same thing in their cities. And so—
And what's that as a result of? Where did that come out of?
We've heard. It's their groundswell of support. And you know, the Progressive Magazine named this campaign the number two campaign to watch for the fall election. So I think it's important that we start to lift up and prioritize solutions from communities of color and tribal communities that have been talking about this for a long time but not getting the airtime.
And before we go on, since we're almost the half hour mark, let's one of you want to talk a little bit about this event on Saturday so people have a sense of that?
Yeah. So the Rise for Climate Jobs and Justice is an event. It's being organized by the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, which will, along with other organizations across the state of Oregon, are really organizing and trying to create a statewide coalition of folks really working towards a just transition. And so some folks have heard of this concept before, but basically a just transition is really moving from an extractive economy that we currently have to a more regenerative economy. So one that's really based on people and puts people over profit. And so this event on Saturday will really be about elevating frontline leadership in the work. So that's leadership, of primarily of people of color, of rural communities, and really looking at how do we reconnect to folks in order to look at frontline leadership in order to create solutions to climate change, in order to really understand what climate justice actually looks like. So it'll be a tabling event, as well as we'll have guest speakers and music too.
Okay. And the Glen Haven Park escapes me. Where is it?
Glen Haven Park, I believe. Actually, not exactly certain where Glen Haven Park.
7900 Northeast Siskiyou.
Yeah.
7900 Northeast Siskiyou. Okay. We'll mention that again at the end of this program. It's coming up on 8:30. And I thought I had the sheet to let people know what's coming up on KBOO this morning. I'll try to locate that. And my guests are Tony DeFalco, Executive Director at Verde, which is working on, along with many other groups, on this Portland Clean Energy Fund initiative, and Adrian Cato, Youth Organizer at Opal Environmental Justice Oregon, which is a member of the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, which she was just talking about. And I don't know if we still have those two callers. Jay, I just got handed, so let me let people know what's coming up on KBOO. At 9 on Political Perspectives, Lisa Loving talks to members of New Avenues for Youth's PAVE program, helping homeless and at-risk youth find skills and employment in the metro area. At 9:30, The Politics of Living explores what makes us happy and how to pay attention to our internal programming. At 10, Air Cascadia gives you headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Bike Show brings you news and views of cycling in Oregon. And beyond all of these, KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you have not yet and would like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Let's go to Jay. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. This is for both Adrian and Tony. How will this be funded, and who are the opponents? And for the clean jobs, clean energy jobs, who will be prioritized? Will the homeless, for example, be prioritized? Thank you. That'll be it.
Thanks, Jay, for the question. I'm happy to start with it. And so the funds are generated through a 1% business license surcharge increase on businesses that operate in the city of Portland, retailers that generate over $1 billion of revenue nationally and over $500,000 locally. It's a very small number of businesses that are impacted. Food, groceries, medicine are exempt. Our utilities are exempt, so there's very little regressivity to this surcharge. And the funds are, as, like Adrian says, about $30 million a year. And the opportunities for jobs, job creation, contracting opportunities are focused on historically disenfranchised and disadvantaged communities. So low-income people, which would include homeless folks, people of color, women, and the businesses they own and operate are prioritized for the job training opportunities, job opportunities in projects. And I want to just highlight one thing, going back to that issue of how much will this create. So $30 million, it doesn't seem like a lot in terms of the kind of the challenge we face. In Multnomah County alone, there are 14 megawatts of capacity available on rooftops of multifamily affordable housing projects.
And how does that compare to, say, the production of Bonneville? Do you have any idea?
I don't know.
Okay.
It's very small. And yet, it's 14 megawatts of capacity that is not being currently utilized in renters who are low income, and some of them pay utility bills $300 a month, and so that would per kilowatt, you're talking $40-50 million of installation costs. So if you start to think about that over time, $30 million a year, and that number grows, is really a substantial way to invest in our communities to start to get at this issue, and at the same time create those job training and job opportunities.
Do we have another caller? Jack, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a question for Tony. Tony, I'm a owner of a modest home in Southeast Portland, and I get calls frequently to be enlisted into a solar panel installation program. I'm told that the panels will be installed for free and that it'll be a great thing. I usually have a question for the people who are proposing this. First of all, if they actually live in Western Oregon, and if they actually know how much cloud cover we have over the course of the year, and if they think that I would really do something here. A couple of times people have said, well, ask me for my address. I give it to them. They look me up on the on some kind of a satellite map, and they say to me, well, you'd probably qualify if you cut down some of the trees around your house. At any rate, my response then is, so you want me to cut down on emissions by using solar panels by cutting trees, which are the best scrubbers of CO2 that I'm aware of. At any rate, could you respond to that? I just need to know, what I'd like to know is, would this program really help me?
Sure. Thanks for the question. So keep your trees. I'm a big bird watcher, so I appreciate having those trees for the birds as well. It is a good question. In terms of solar productivity, Oregon surprisingly has good solar production capacity. What I would highlight is that this isn't just about solar. This is about the whole spectrum of ways in which we can reduce our carbon emissions, ranging from energy efficiency through insulation, solar panels. We're talking about programmatic activities like getting people out and walking and riding bikes more. And so it really is the opportunity for us to make a broad spectrum of investments in communities that lead to these outcomes of reduced emissions, increased economic opportunity, more communities coming out and being active in the space, in particular in the green infrastructure space, where you have very few people of color and women-owned businesses actively participating. And so the last thing I'd share is that, this is really a way of building a broader progressive movement. And I think that that's one of the things that we're most excited about, is that we know, for example, that people of color support climate protection and climate legislation at higher rates than whites. And yet, you often don't see them at the forefront of the campaigns to achieve climate goals. And so this is a way of bringing us closer together, side by side, to win on this issue, but more importantly, to build a durable, progressive majority going into November and beyond.
So this is on the ballot for November?
Correct. Yep. On the ballot for November, measure 26201. And, I think what I would share in terms of why people should vote for it is that, number one, it gets at something we know is real and is known and impacting wildlife, our communities, and that is climate. Number two is that it gets at something we know is impacting our society, and that is really disparate access to economic opportunity that hits the poorest and the brownest among us hardest. And three, that it builds this broader progressive majority. So I encourage you all out there, vote yes on 26201 in November.
So I don't think you got to the second point of the previous caller. Who are the opponents to this measure?
Sure. It's right now the only opposition we've seen is some from the Portland Business Alliance. We've seen a little bit of poking around in terms of them coming out to the City Club. Ballotpalooza, which the City Club has endorsed this measure. So look it up on City Club Line, City Club Online. That's a good report on the details of this mechanism. But we haven't seen a lot more than that. We've heard that they're planning on spending substantial amounts of money to defeat the measure. But we're sort of
you haven't seen TV ads.
No TV ads yet. Yeah, that's right. So we're ready, but we're continuing to build. We have 9 Portland area legislators signed on. We've got 30 churches, 30 pastors signed on, 20 neighborhood associations, literally dozens and dozens of Portland area organizations, progressive, environmental, civil rights, so we've got a broad coalition that we built.
So we have a caller. Let's hold off on them. Just wait a couple minutes. Adrian, I wondered, as the youngest person here in this room,
yeah.
Not that, the prospect of whatever scenario you want to imagine of climate change, rising seas, more and more forest fires, as we've seen the last 2 years, smoky summers, droughts, mega storms, all the bleak scenarios that, again, seem to be happening much more rapidly than even the most pessimistic of us thought a few years ago. You must have to confront sort of the existential reality of this as well. Is that something you want to talk at all about?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, when we come to accept an existential reality is kind of in some ways when we completely lose. I think it's a lot right now about understanding that these things are coming, but also to give us a sense of urgency to really ensure that the communities that will be impacted most are protected and are given the tools in order to really mitigate the effects of climate change. So, I think at this point it is a lot about understanding that we are past a point right now where there are some things that are on the way that are just going to come. But it's really about, like I said, mitigating those effects and ensuring that those who are hit first and worst are given the tools in order to, weather the storm, in a lot of ways, literally. So I think that that's really what it should be about, not necessarily viewing it as an existential crisis, but more as an urgency.
But this whole issue of mitigation, mm-hmm. I've heard this term as an environmental activist. To me, it was always a term of deception, because the idea, you would build some sort of big development, some sort of shopping center, and then you just sort of supposedly mitigate the effects by building some sort of fake wetlands like next door or something. So to me, it was always sort of a tool that the system used to sort of hide its effects. Mm. So I'm very wary of this term mitigate. Not that it can't be used, it's a word that, it means sort of minimize the effects of, sort of deal with the effects of. But I'm very suspicious of utilizing these terms in the context of climate change, because it's like, can we actually mitigate? Do we actually, I just think that people don't really come to grips enough with what's actually happening and the speed that things are actually happening. Because it's, I to the extent that I can get it as a white middle-class person, I think I get the focus on justice. That's, to me, obviously, it's like everything is just so messed up in the history of this country in terms of, the treatment of non-white peoples that it's. But at the same time, we're dealing with we're talking about climate change. So are the things that we're doing actually, I heard what Camillo said, and I've heard what you guys say, but are we actually addressing it, or are we just making ourselves feel better that we're doing something?
Well, I think it's twofold, right? I think that we need to mitigate effects as well as try to reduce them. I think it can't only be to build up a storm wall, right, in a community. I think it's also about how do we really address reducing the like carbon change, greenhouse gases, you know, entering the atmosphere and those other things. But I would say, you know, I think that something that we like to say in the just transition movement is that a transition is inevitable, right? But we aren't ensured that it is just. And I think that when we look at climate change, it's not just, I almost feel like it can't just be looking at climate change, right? It's looking at climate justice and how communities are impacted. So I would say that I feel like they're not separated. I feel like we can't look at climate change without looking at the communities that will be impacted most. And I feel like we have to create a movement that addresses both as we move forward.
And that's how we're going to win. I mean, I think that we're right now, and Paul, you're right, we're losing. And we have an administration that is intent on making us lose faster, and it's punching our communities in the face every day. And I'm not a violent person. I don't like to use violent metaphors, but right now we have to be very aggressive in responding and not reacting, but being proactive in our approach. And I think what Portland Clean Energy Fund, while it's modest in terms of the scale at which it installs new generation or conservation, is a way for Portlanders to right now in this bleak climate we're in to come together and say no, enough, and yes, we want to see this positive energy future. And what that does is that starts the ball rolling, and the ball gets bigger, and we get bigger and bigger wins.
And do we have any callers? Go ahead, Phil, you're on the air.
Hello. I want to caution that what's really needed is weatherization. That's what affects people with less income, people who can't afford heat, energy poverty. And putting rooftop solar on a multifamily home will probably benefit some homeowner and not the renters. So I don't think this is focused correctly. Putting money into training doesn't help when there are no jobs. We're not weatherizing homes. Energy Trust has $100 million a year to spend on weatherization, and they spend probably $500,000 of that correctly. And there are 1,000 homes maybe that they weatherize, when we should be doing at least 50,000 a year. The workers who have been in this with me for 12 years and more have all dropped out. The last time I was at an Energy Trust Trade Ally meeting, I think I was the only person who stood up doing installation. So where are the jobs? What can be done with solar rooftop that will benefit people? And let's bear in mind that this failed to make the ballot statewide, pretty much the same measure with the same shortcomings. A much better plan is on the ballot in the state of Washington.
Thanks, Phil. And so I'll share, too, our experience at Verde. So we ran a weatherization firm from 2008 to 2013, and we had to shutter it at that time because the market conditions changed, and the incentives for homeowners changed, and the ERA money dried up. And so we're very clear-eyed about the challenges that face both of these industries, weatherization as well as solar installation with the tariffs. You've gotten increased costs around panels. And so we're not obtuse to the challenges in the economics around bringing this infrastructure to low-income communities. And yet, we are very clear about the need for this infrastructure to come to low-income communities, because they have not received those benefits largely. And so, like I noted earlier, you have people paying really outrageous energy bills. And what I learned during this campaign still shocks me to this day is that the number one reason that people take out payday loans is to pay utility bills. That, in my mind, is criminal. That is something that we as a country should be ashamed of. And this is a Portland Clean Energy Fund starts to shift resources toward those communities so that we can find innovative ways to bring energy efficiency investments, weatherization investments, solar investments, other forms of reducing carbon into those communities. And is it perfect right now? Absolutely not. in terms of the situation with the market, as you identified, and the challenges of being in these industries? Is it a way of the public sector saying, yes, we want more of that, and finding ways to incentivize it? It absolutely is.
Okay, and 503-231-8187 is the number. Let's go right to our next caller. We only have about 15 minutes, so if you want to get your calls in, do it in the next 5 minutes or so. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I had a question about this. So I'm kind of late to the conversation, so I apologize. I don't know if it's anything you've gone over, but how does this plan, or does it even address the local big ag in our area, the big agriculture, in terms of because I mean that's one of our biggest problems not just in this country but in the world, is big agriculture. And does the plan involve anything to address that, and even maybe people taking steps in that direction, like doing talking to people about reducing meat consumption, or
okay, or okay. I go ahead. I think your the line isn't so great, and I think we got the gist of your question.
Okay,
go ahead, Tony.
I'll start, and then it'd be great, Adrian, if you could jump in too. So Portland Clean Energy Fund, 10 to 15% of the funds on an annual basis are available for innovative and sustainable agriculture projects and programs that reduce fossil fuel emissions, shorten the supply chains, really focus on locally produced food. And so that's a really big benefit of this measure. And then I think at the statewide level, I know that the Oregon Just Transition Alliance has a working group on food, which of course is really important in our communities.
Yeah, absolutely. The OJTA is actually working to create quite a few working groups. So one on food justice, one on energy, one on immigration, and I believe there's a fourth that we are working towards creating. But you know, I would say specifically with PSEF, I think it's an example of seeing a just transition in action, right? So one of the principles is to shift money, right? So shift money towards the frontline communities that are really being impacted by climate change and by environmental injustice is just a really poignant and important example of that. Shifting those funds towards creating projects towards a sustainable future.
So getting back to the bigger question, which I just can't let go. So I don't know if it was like 10, 15 years ago, this slogan, system change, not climate change, became sort of, it was even seen on sort of the main banners of some of the big marches and stuff. I don't see that too much anymore. But so that idea, though, it's a challenging one. Because you're talking about basically sort of tweaking the system here, but is it actually necessary to completely change the economic? Can this be done under? Can we address climate change under the capitalist system? I mean, with 10 minutes to go in the program, it's kind of a big, big thing to. Well, I'm just hearing pause there. My engineer was talking to me, says we've got a long distance caller who we will get to, but I'd like you to, maybe take that question up briefly, since we don't have a whole lot of time. sorry to do this to you, but what do you think about this idea of can it be done under capitalism or not?
I think that it's a very extensive kind of philosophical question, when we're talking about capitalism as a whole. And when we look at it, it is true that it puts profits over the well-being of people. And I think that's part of what we're seeing right now, and the reason that we're seeing such horrible, climate change effects is that we're both exploiting individuals and we're exploiting the environment. So there's that question of, can we at least continue to function in all the ways that we do right now and still move towards a sustainable future? I think, I don't know if that can all be answered right here, but I think that we also at the same time have to function in the world that we live in right now. So that's really, really key is that, of course, we can imagine these better futures, but at the same time, we have to imagine our futures through the systems that we're currently working in and break towards better ones. So I think that's just part of the reality of this work.
I just share that we absolutely have to move toward a more redistributive economy. For too long, we have concentrated wealth in the hands of a very few numbers at the expense of a large number of people in our society, and that divide grows every minute, literally. And so I think what we're trying to do in very small ways at Verde and with this campaign and co-leading with all the other organizations on board is to demonstrate a way in which we can both get double wins, right? Environmental wins and economic justice wins, build a progressive majority, and demonstrate how to reinvest, how to redistribute these scarce public resources into communities that have not experienced those benefits. And I think, Paul, to answer your very good question, is that that is the tip of the spear relative to the transformation of our economy. And the more we can do that, the more we can demonstrate success in doing that, and PSEF is one of those things, the more we can have broader movement toward those kinds of activities around this country.
Well, let's on that note, let's go to our long-distance caller. Tremaine, go ahead. You're on the air.
It's a good program. Thank you. I'm going to talk just a minute just about mitigation funds. The Bonneville Power Administration has been providing mitigation funds for the damage they did to the salmon runs. So they're providing millions of dollars to various nonprofits, and I'm on the board of a big one, where they provide monies where we can purchase large chunks of land and put them in conservation easements along rivers and do some restoration work on rivers to encourage the return of the salmon. And these mitigation funds come from BPA. They've been going for years. And so many, many groups in the Willamette Valley and receive these, well over millions of dollars. So that's a form of mitigation that you need to know about besides mitigating, building developments and then mitigating and doing that.
But wouldn't it be even more effective to, take down, the Grand Coulee Dam or something like that?
Yeah, but that's a discussion that's been going on for a long time, and
we haven't gotten very far.
I'm talking about the millions of dollars that are currently going to some large groups, including tribal groups, the Grand Ronde group, where they're buying and been able to preserve chunks of land along the rivers right now. The tearing down of dams is another issue, but the mitigation funds are what I'm talking about that are currently being spent in the Willamette Valley.
No, I hear what you're saying, but my point is germane because these are the indirect methods. We continually, because the capitalist system is so absolutely viciously dominant and controls our lives in ways that we don't even acknowledge often, we can't go against it because it's so strong. So what we do is we take these indirect ways and we don't, we no longer have, if we ever had, a real revolutionary force to actually combat it directly. So instead, we sort of retreat. We take these secondary. Anyway, I could go off on that. We only have 8 minutes left, and I appreciate your call. And I'm not against any of these things. I'm just...
No, but the thing is, but basically, the point you're making is fine. But I'm talking about what's being done right now, which is including growing out native seeds to restore the habitat for various endangered butterflies that are going on right now. There's a lot of stuff that's going on the ground. I understand what you say about the capitalist system, and I'm with you on that. It's just that I wanted to point out there are things that are happening that at least mitigate somewhat the damage that was done by all those dams, and where we're restoring some habitat for the fender blue butterfly, the Tater's checker spot butterfly, and the silver spot. A lot of people are currently on the ground doing that right now. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on right now.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Tremaine.
You're
welcome. I appreciate that. We've only got about 5 minutes left. Like to remind people that there's this Rise for Climate Jobs and Justice community gathering at Glen Haven Park, which is at 7900 Siskiyou Northeast, Portland. That's this Saturday, September 8th, from noon to 4 p.m. So you can meet. I assume you two will be there.
I will.
You can meet Adrian and Tony and all their compatriots and comrades and co-workers and
and whoever else shows up, you can meet. And there'll be music and speakers and tables. And this is all gearing up to whatever the first Tuesday in November, where this Clean Energy Fund initiative will be on the ballot. So what are people doing to get out the vote?
Well, I'll start. I would say that let's be very clear here that this is a measure designed to hold corporations in our state accountable. We've crafted this measure to target large retailers that have very long supply chains that have received the benefit of a 21% tax cut in November of 2017 and are operating in the state with one of the lowest corporate tax rates in the country. And this measure is going right at those dollars and saying you need to be part of the solution. You need to pay your fair share for the actions that you are taking and that are impacting our communities, and that we are going and saying you will provide resources to start to turn the ship in the other direction. And so I think that is very powerful. That's very powerful in our city. That's very powerful in our state. And it's even more powerful because it's people of color that are coming up and saying, we are going to do this. We are going to hold you accountable. And so again, voters, everyone out there, vote for this. You can get involved with Get Out the Vote. We need folks to go door to door. We need folks to do phone banking. You can go on our website at PortlandCleanEnergyFund.com and sign up to volunteer.
Yeah, I think I would also just, echo that and say that, to not underestimate the power of localized movements like this, to really, and looking at the Portland Clean Energy Fund, it's an example where in the city of Portland, we're going to be reinvesting funds back into communities and back into green jobs and to green infrastructure, and how that is really important and does have far-reaching impact.
And actually, we do have a couple minutes left. I discouraged Tammy from bringing her phone caller on. Sorry about that. she's looking at me, giving me a dirty look. Anyway, give us a quick call. But Just Transition Alliance, talk a little bit more about what they're doing locally.
Yeah, the Oregon Just Transition Alliance, we're continuing to create a both localized as well as statewide coalition of community groups that are frontline led. So those are people of color led community groups, groups from rural communities further across the state of Oregon. And right now we are still in the stages of both supporting the work that's being done with PSEF as well as forming our other working groups and in the future kind of deciding a specific campaign that'll be worked on. So it's, it's about creating that coalition building, but also working towards future campaign work in order to specifically address other areas that we can create a just transition in. So whether that's food justice, everything in energy. So that's really what we're working on right now.
Well, I guess we are just about out of time. Once again, thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having us, Paul.
Tony DeFalco, Executive Director at Verde, and Adrian Cato, Youth Organizer at Opal Environmental Justice Oregon. Again, this Saturday at Glen Haven Park, 7900 Northeast Siskiyou, here in Portland, Rise for Climate Jobs and Justice Community Gathering. That's noon to 4 p.m. Thank you all for listening. This is Paul Rowland with KBO Talk, Wednesday Talk Radio.
The sun. But that was then, now the summer locks the land in an iron embrace, and the sun hits hard, hard as a hammer, and the sour seas surge, and the rivers run dry, and an acrid stench leaks from the sky, and it feels like we're at war with nature.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KABU is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KABU will be hosting Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. This film from 1980 chronicles the life of country singer Loretta Lynn. Sissy Spacek brings sincerity and depth to her portrait of Loretta and does her own singing in the movie, as does Beverly D'Angelo in the role of Patsy Cline. Tommy Lee Jones also delivers one of his best performances. Again, that's Coal Miner's Daughter on Wednesday, September 5th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of EFFECT on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon White Stag Block in Portland. EFFECT is a two-day conference that examines the work, culture, and design of social change. This grassroots event featuring stories from multiple marginalized activists, creators, and technologists working towards social change. Again, that's AFFECT on Thursday and Friday, September 6th and 7th at the University of Oregon, White Stag Block, 70 Northwest Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming right up, it's Lisa Loving on Political Perspectives Today, talking to members of New Avenues for Youth, their PAVE program, helping homeless and at-risk youth find skills and employment in the metro area. At 9:30, The Politics of Living explores what makes us happy and how to pay attention to our internal programming. At 10 o'clock, stay tuned for Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and camp commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, and at 11 o'clock, The Bike Show brings you news